One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When Diplomacy Fails presents The July Crisis Anniversary Project, a day-by-day account of the events that occurred 100 years ago. Persuading Teza. Today is the 14th of July, 2014. And on this day, 100 years ago, occurred the following events. As the Hungarian minister-president, and thus the representative of his kingdom's interests, Stefan Tisza felt he had every reason for opposing war. Bringing more ethnic nationals into the Habsburg Empire would surely destabilize it even further. Such a war of conquest and partition would also dilute the Hungarian presence, since it would be balanced against new ethnicities within the theoretically conquered Serbia. Tisza had yet to be given serious evidence to implicate Serbia in the crime of the 28th of June, though he would certainly have had his suspicions like everyone else. As the joint premier of the Habsburg Empire, he would also have been up to date with military plans, mostly concerning Hungary, but also for the empire as a whole, so he would surely have realized the state that the Austro-Hungarian armed forces were in. Because of these reasons, Tisza's convictions had only been strengthened in the face of the pro-war party, which contained both his counterpart, the Austrian minister-president, and the foreign minister. He had utilized his considerable pull to veto any plans for immediate action against Serbia in the early stages, and had thereafter thrown out plans to mount a secretive war against the Balkan state. Tisza had opted instead for a diplomatic approach, which would surely result in the same victory once the Serbs acquiesced. This would also have removed any scrutiny from the international community. Austria-Hungary, Tisza believed, would not be the bad guy if it followed his strategy. A diplomatic victory was nothing to sneeze at, and it would signal to the other regional powers that Austria was still capable of standing up to its neighbours when needs be. Having carried these convictions, virtually alone in the Habsburg government, for the past 2 weeks, though, Tisza was finally weakening. On the morning of Tuesday, the 14th of July, 1914, he knew Berchtold would be expecting an answer from him, and the previous weekend of anti-Habsburg demonstrations in the Serb press and on the streets of Belgrade, combined with the attacks against Austro-Hungarian honour, were removing his walls of resistance. When he met Berchtold that morning on the 14th, he told him that, as each day passed, he had been strengthened in the conviction that Austria-Hungary must come to a bold resolve to demonstrate its vitality and put an end to the unendurable state of affairs in the southeast. Tisza was informed of German urging and promises of support, having been before sceptical of the sincerity of Germany to aid its ally. Tisza now had to admit that he was particularly impressed by the unconditional manner in which Germany has ranged herself at the side of the dual monarchy. While Tisza said it had not been easy to take the decision of advising war, he was now convinced of its necessity. The final straw for Tisza had been the anti-Habsburg demonstrations, but Berchtold was able to add to the Hungarians' frustration at the situation by providing the dossier on the assassination that had been conducted by Dr. Friedrich von Weizsäcker. The language that expressed strong suspicion towards Serb involvement and noted complicity of someone in Serbia so as to arm the agents and get them across the border was then added to the German language urging action and promising support. With this ammo, which Berchtold had collected for the very purpose of persuading Tisza, the Hungarians' resistance ended. By all accounts, it seemed, Berchtold had finally won. The indefatigable Hungarian had apparently given in after a fortnight of stalling and resistance. The price exacted by Tisza's stalling, though, was fundamentally problematic. Even the most vengeful of Habsburg statesmen could see that after a fortnight of inaction, suddenly reacting to the assassination with an ultimatum would appear opportunistic and coldly cynical abroad. An ultimatum would now be necessary too, though, since an all-out attack so long after the 28th of June would be viewed as a preemptive strike rather than a campaign of vengeance, which, as Berchtold had tried to stress to Tisza, much of Europe would surely have understood better at the time. But no European state allied to Serbia would be able to stand for an attack now. The solution left to Austria-Hungary then, Berchtold reasoned, was to create the ultimatum now and deliver it as soon as possible. Berchtold was especially well disposed towards the idea of sending the ultimatum with haste. He had in fact communicated the Austrian ambassador to Germany the plan that would ensure the ultimatum was delivered to Serbia by the late night of the next day, Wednesday the 15th of July, a whole week before the original delivery time. The ultimatum would be accompanied by a 48-hour time limit, and though he ignored the harvest leave issue that had so flummoxed the Chief of Staff Conrad, it still seemed like a viable option to the Foreign Minister. At the very least, acting with haste now would hopefully remove the reputation he had in Germany for dithering indecisively in matters of state. The Germans, Berchtold hoped, would be pleased. However, there was another sneakier reason why Berchtold wanted to send the ultimatum to Belgrade in the late hours on the night of Wednesday the 15th of July. It was well known that the French president, Raymond Poincaré, would be travelling to St. Petersburg for an important summit with the Russian Tsar. Poincaré would be travelling by ship up the Baltic and would not arrive at the Russian capital until Monday the 20th of July. While he travelled, Berchtold wanted to make use of the 5 days of radio silence that would result from being on a Baltic cruiser by acting before the two Entente leaders had a chance to cooperate in person. If the ultimatum was delivered on the night of the 15th, it would expire on Friday the 17th, giving Austria-Hungary roughly 2 days to mobilize and act against Serbia before Russia and France could coordinate a strategy. By then, it was hoped, Belgrade would be in Habsburg hands, and even if this process was delayed by a day, it would still enable a window of opportunity for the Habsburgs to act against Serbia before its Entente allies could provide an answer. By following this plan, Berchtold would dodge the problems posed to Austrian plans by having the Russian and French leaders in the same place at once. If both leaders were together while word of the ultimatum and attack filtered in, then they could coordinate a joint response restricted by none of the communication barriers of the time. In other words, Berchtold did not want the two leaders anywhere near each other once the first started to fly in Belgrade. To have the two leaders apart was preferable, but it would surely be even better if the French president was stranded on some Baltic vessel and out of the loop of current events. This was the plan of the now empowered Foreign Minister of Austria-Hungary, to operate in the shadows, to deceive and bypass the other powers and prevent Serbia's allies from physically conversing so as to make the attack on Serbia, by now no longer blocked by the Hungarian minister-president, go off without a hitch. This plan of Berchtold's, of course, did not account for the harvest leave issue. But perhaps Berchtold believed that once the ultimatum had been rejected it wouldn't matter if the rest of the world knew that Habsburg citizens were no longer at home on their farms, and were instead preparing for war. However, the biggest stumbling block to this plan of deception was not logistical. It was again Hungarian. Stefan Tisza, though he had come across reluctantly to the war party, did not yet relinquish his hold over Habsburg policy. He remained true to his commitment of the 7th of July at the council, in which the ultimatum was developed, and where part of his terms was that he had to approve the text of this ultimatum. This wouldn't necessarily have slowed down the process too much. Berchtold would still be able to put his plan into effect. he did have a day or maybe two to play with. However, Tisa was not merely suggesting that he alone read the text of the ultimatum at his private study. Instead, he was insisting that the whole ministerial council approve the text while in session. Okay, Berchtold may not yet have panicked, except for the fact that the ministerial council could not meet until Sunday the 19th of July. This dramatic slowdown of Berchtold's plan pretty much meant that he had to rethink his entire strategy. If he went ahead with the plan to send it as soon as the council convened, then the ultimatum would be sent roughly around the 21st or 22nd of July. That would be in the middle of the Franco-Russian summit, when the two Entente leaders were together in person. If Berchtold presented such a crisis to the two leaders then the fear was that the two would be able to immediately develop a joint strategy that would ruin Austrian plans against Serbia, and that the Franco-Russian Entente would be able to push back any signs of pressure against their Balkan ally. There was no way that Berchtold was going to allow the ultimatum to be sent at that time period then, not when, as he put it, the two leaders would be swearing an oath of brotherhood under the influence of champagne. He told the German ambassador to Austria that it would be good if all the toasts were over before the note is delivered. Thus Berchtold now resigned himself to the fact that he would have to wait until the French president was leaving his Russian host, which Berchtold mistakenly believed was Saturday the 25th of July. Only then, the foreign minister upheld, could the ultimatum be sent, a whole month after the original assassination took place. Though on the surface it seemed catastrophically inept to delay for so long, if the assassination was old news now, imagine the passing of two more weeks. The wait did have much to recommend it to Berchtold. Not only would the harvest leave process have definitely ended, but with the French president leaving rather than arriving to meet the Russian Tsar, the two allies would be even less well disposed to coordinate strategy, since they would both have to wait at least 4 days before the French delegation arrived home. By waiting until July 25th, Berchtold would rob Poincaré the chance to put steel into Sazonov and the Russian Tsar. Poincaré was upheld by the Central Powers as perhaps the most belligerent of all the European rulers, and Berchtold did not, under any circumstances, want him in a position to talk the Tsar or his ministers into war. Berchtold at this stage still believed in the German ideology, which revolved around Russian non-intervention in the event of an attack on Serbia. As the strongest statesman at the summit, if Berchtold operated while Poincaré was on the journey home, no one would be there to egg on the Tsar. For this new plan to succeed, though, the utmost secrecy was required. If the French or Russians caught wind of the plan for an ultimatum before it was sent, then they could coordinate the very response in person that Berchtold so feared. Furthermore, it would be a Franco-Russian atmosphere made all the more acidic by the revelation that Berchtold had tried to dupe them both. If Poincaré discovered that the ultimatum had been orchestrated with the express purpose of avoiding him and his summit, then it would light a fire under him, and would virtually guarantee his determination to press for a harsh response. Berchtold would have to thus ensure that no word of his plans leaked out before the ultimatum was delivered on the 25th of July. This would be a process aided by a lack of suspicion or interest in his affairs from the point of view of other foreign dignitaries, with Britain occupied with the Irish question, and France mostly focusing on the political scandal wrapped up in the Callot affair. Such foreign disinterest didn't seem too difficult to achieve. The major issue was Russia. However, Berchtold had been given the additional good news that its foreign minister, Sergei Sazonov, would be vacationing until, as it happened, the 19th of July, when Austria-Hungary would debate the contents of the ultimatum and finalise its delivery plans. The possibility for leaks thus seemed small, and if Berchtold could indeed pull it off, the results would be just as impressive as he planned. Poincaré would be miles away from relevant information on his Baltic vessel, and the Tsar would be without his stiffening influence. Berchtold was further encouraged by the fact that he had already sent the War Minister and the Chief of Staff Conrad on extended vacation, so as to give the impression that nothing was amiss. Berchtold was surely thankful that neither would be present to potentially reveal to subordinates or others, in their excitement, of the impending plans for the ultimatum. He needed the operations to be watertight, but he informed both that they would be required to attend the ministerial council meeting insisted upon by Tisza. Berchtold told them not to worry, though. He would provide public excuses for them to both momentarily break off their holidays and venture to the Austro-Hungarian capital. The foreign minister had then, by a result of his own previously understated cunning, developed a new plan from the old one that had been wrecked by Tisza's controlling. It was still a perfectly viable plan, so long as nobody outside of the loop got wind of its designs. Berchtold, perhaps not even willing to trust himself, called off his weekly reception for foreign ambassadors, and met with them only on request. It seemed as though he had checked every possibility for leakage, and had plugged every hole he could find. Vienna was still crawling with diplomats and journalists, not to mention spies, though, and all had expected some sort of response from Vienna by now. Since no response had been forthcoming, they eagerly searched through every shred of evidence and rumour they could locate to try and paint their own picture of what was happening. It was these individuals that Berchtold so feared. If even one of them got hold of any info regarding the ultimatum plans, then it would be a matter of a few hours before the capitals of Europe knew of Habsburg intentions. However, it was Berchtold himself who, having reinforced all communication lines between the upper circle, failed to see the possibility of leaks within the meetings he conducted with his German ally. On the afternoon of Tuesday the 14th of July, merely hours after meeting with Tisza and being furnished with a new plan of action, Berchtold met with the German ambassador to Austria and the chief of foreign affairs in the Ballplatz. But he also allowed an old friend to sit in on the talks, Count Heinrich von Lützow, who had served as the ambassador to Italy from 1904 to 1910, but had since retired. Berchtold, treating him as a sort of wise man elder, had permitted the old man to sit on his closed meeting with the Allied VIPs, and while he had been there, he had left everything out in the open about the ultimatum and the plans to keep the war localized. This seems to have horrified the career diplomat Lützow, who called the idea of localizing the war a fantasy. That Tuesday, Lützow left Vienna for his country estate, and felt so concerned by the conversation he had had with Berchtold and those present that he elected to tell someone, setting in motion one of the most interesting, but also catastrophic for Austria-Hungary, examples of leaking information, which would in the end ruin Berchtold's plans for secrecy and jeopardize the entire ultimatum plan, although Berchtold would never know until it was too late.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.